This is a special feature produced for download from ABC Classic FM's website. Due to copyright restrictions on the music, it's been edited to make this possible.
On air, online, and now on digital radio, Margaret Throsby with you, ABC Classic FM. Imagine being told by a specialist that you have a disease which is progressive, degenerative, and incurable. This is what happened to our guest today, Karen Ager, at the tender age of 17, when she learned that she had rheumatoid arthritis. This destructive disease can cause damage and deformities to affected joints in the body, pain and swelling and morning stiffness, especially in the joints of the hands. They're common symptoms, but it can also affect the lower limbs. And it can affect other organs too, like the eyes, the lungs, the kidneys and the skin. But in Karen's case, the disease didn't reckon on who it was dealing with. This remarkable woman, despite feeling appalled at the toll rheumatoid arthritis was taking on her body, and despite periods of depression and fear and anger and despair, she managed to tackle the problem head on, and she's become a dedicated campaigner to bringing awareness of this crippling disease to the public. Often we have medical specialists on the program to give us the expert's view. This time we have the patient, the person who's experienced the symptoms and learned her own way of dealing with her disease. Karen Ager is our guest, and rheumatoid arthritis is our topic, in a conversation accompanied by music that Karen has chosen. A movement from the Winter Concerto of the Four Seasons by Vivaldi, played there by the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, chosen by our guest today, Karen Ager. Karen, good morning.
Good morning,
Welcome
Margaret.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about your choice of music, the first one, the Vivaldi. Why was that there?
Oh, I love it because it's just such an energetic and vibrant piece of music, and often I'll listen to that on my iPod on the way to work before I have to face the children.
Facing the children is what you do as a teacher, isn't it, in New York? And I'd like to find out about that job because it sounds really interesting a bit later. But can we look at rheumatoid arthritis to start with? How much is known about rheumatoid arthritis?
Well, it's a greatly misunderstood disease, I think. It's an autoimmune disease where the body attacks itself. But people really think that arthritis is an old person's disease, and it's just not. It really affects 2/3 of the people who have it are under 65 in the US anyway.
Is it the same as osteoarthritis or not?
No. It's as I said, the rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease. Osteoarthritis is really with overuse of joints or a sporting injury.
I see. They're so what happens in rheumatoid? What do we call it? RA? Do you shorten it? Okay. So what happens to the joints in RA? What typically goes on in the joints?
Well, they don't know whether it's viral or bacterial or a genetic cause, but the joints are basically eaten away at by the immune system itself, and that causes joint immobility and damage and chronic pain. And often if I'm having what I call a flare-up, it will come on so suddenly on a bad day that, you know, I'll almost be wheelchair-bound.
Is that so?
Yeah.
All right. Now, I've read it's more common in women than men. Is mm-hmm. that right?
Yes.
So women are more likely, I think, 3 times more likely to get rheumatoid.
I'm not exactly sure of the numbers. Yeah. I think 2/3.
Okay.
2/3.
Okay. Is it unusual for it to develop in a 17-year-old as it did with you?
Well, there are 300,000 children in the United States that have rheumatoid arthritis. It is unusual, but it's not something that's not seen.
Mm. Give us a sense of your life up to the time you were diagnosed, before RA came into your life. What sort of physique did you have? What sort of medical history? I mean, were you a healthy, happy Australian kid bouncing around like most of them do?
Absolutely. I was a swimmer and a basketball player at school. I had all the hopes and dreams that you have of you know, in your adolescent years, and just wanted to keep up with my friends and just do everything that young teenage girls do.
Where did you grow up? Where were you born and where were you raised?
I was born in Sydney actually, and I was raised in Melbourne.
But you spent some of your childhood in Papua New Guinea.
Yes.
Tell me why.
My father was an airline pilot for Trans-Australian Airlines, TAA at the time, and we moved over there, my mother and my brother and myself and my father, when I was 6 weeks old.
How long were you there?
We were there 3.5 years.
Do you remember it?
I remember leaving. I remember sort of the final year, I guess, and remember leaving Mataremma, my best friend, who was our housekeeper's child.
Okay. So that happened when you were a little kid. Mm-hmm. Then you went and lived in Melbourne, mm-hmm. and you had a normal sort of, and you were a keen outdoorsy sort of swimmy sort of girl.
Right. And in fact, I never had a sick day really in high school until my final year.
Now, what happened? You were 17 when you were diagnosed, but when did you show, when you look back past when you were 17 to when you were 16, 15, 14, mm-hmm. were there signs that something was amiss?
Well, I'm a very tall girl.
You're 6 feet, I think, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, and we always thought that the pains that I had in my legs were growing pains. And so, you know, I'd go to bed with an aspirin and I'd wake up the next day and I'd feel fine.
How old was this happening?
This started actually from when I was a little girl, you know, a young girl under 10. But we didn't think anything of it. It was just like it was growing pains. So, and it would go away. And then I was always fatigued. Mum would go mad at me because I'd never want to get out of bed, and she just thought I was being a difficult teenager, but really my body needed to sleep. And then the first dramatic sign, I guess, was on Blackrock Beach in Melbourne when I couldn't get off my towel on the beach and my cousin had to carry me home because I had a sharp pain in my right hip.
Just something you said back there was about, you mentioned the word bacteria. They're not sure whether it's bacterial mm-hmm. or viral.
Or genetic.
Is it thought? I mean, is there a school of thought that thinks that a virus could have been the initiator of this, that somebody might have a viral infection of some kind and as a result of that later on show rheumatoid arthritis?
They really don't know.
Because I'm just wondering if the Papua New Guinea story has something to do with it.
I've wondered that.
Whether there was something in the environment there that...
I know, right? I've wondered that myself. I also had glandular fever. That was not until my final year of school.
Is that typical of stories of people with RA, that they've had something like glandular fever in their life?
Well, not necessarily, but it's an autoimmune. It's another autoimmune kind of illness.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And a viral one.
You could play detective forever, I suppose, right. Trying to work out why you got it. Was it in the family? Was there any?
No.
So this was the first time. So no wonder people were puzzled by why mm-hmm. their 6 foot tall 15, 16 year old was tired. And had pain.
Right.
So then on Blackrock Beach, you couldn't get up off the towel because you had what? You had sharp pain, you said.
I had a sharp pain in my right hip and I literally could not get off that towel by myself.
What did you think had happened?
I just thought I'd pulled a muscle. I just thought it was something I'd done, you know, maybe riding my bike to school or whatever. And then when I couldn't get up off the towel, David, my cousin, carried me home, and that was the end of it. I went to bed, slept it off, had an aspirin, and that was it for a little while.
For how long?
So a couple of months, I guess.
And
now I sort of consider that was a flare, just a flare. And then I started to have more flares more consistently. And by flare, I mean when you get the red swelling around the joints and the heat in the joints, and then the joints pretty well become immobilized very quickly.
So that one was in your hip, and
yeah.
Eventually you did have a hip replacement, I
yes.
know that. But
yes.
were the flares then more common in your hands?
Because it's a disease that's in the blood, And so it travels. So it would go from joint to joint. And the thing about RA is it's predictably unpredictable. You never know where it's going to strike you.
When was, I mean, I presume alarm bells were starting to ring in your parents' head. You know, what is wrong with Karen? You know, why is she getting these funny episodes of pain? When did someone take you to a doctor and ask for a diagnosis?
When I was 17, you know, it's in the book, actually, in my first chapter, which I would always just say to Mum, can you just read the first two chapters and then get through to the end? Because my parents were going through a divorce at the time. And I think what can happen in families is parents can become so distracted by their own pain that you often don't see what's going on in the environment that you're living in with your children. So I feel that that perhaps happened a little bit with me, but then I went to the doctor, you know, at 17, and he diagnosed me. So
what did you think? Did you know what RA was?
Didn't have a clue. And the buzzwords were, you know, progressive, degenerative, incurable.
That word incurable must be a doozy to hear coming out of a doctor's mouth.
Right. But do you know, as a 17-year-old, for whatever reason, I slipped straight into denial, and it was almost like I just got a bout of influenza. And I remember getting back in the car. Mum was pretty silent. We had all the prescriptions for the medications and just put the music on loud and didn't want to talk about it, and just thought, oh, well, you know, I'll take the tablets and I'll be fine.
What was the medication? What sort of stuff were you taking?
They started me off on prednisone, which is a steroid, straight away to get the inflammation down because I was pretty immobilized. And then, you know, a host of anti-inflammatories. What happens with RA and some of the autoimmune diseases is you go through a tier of drugs. You know, if something doesn't work, you move on to the higher tier of drugs.
Mm. And that was what you were doing. You were moving ever upwards, up the tier. Golly.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you begin to notice deformity in your joints? I'm looking at your hands now.
Yeah.
They, I mean, you can see that there is the bones are, they're a bit knobbly on the finger joints and in the wrists.
Mm-hmm.
When did that start to appear?
Well, I've had a very aggressive form of the disease, so it was pretty quick. It was probably by my early 20s I had signs of deformity and my body was not really symmetrical anymore. If you look closely at me, my right shoulder's forward, and then I had a noticeable limp, and then my wrists fused together and my hands started to deform. So it was very fast.
It's pretty cruel for a young girl, for anybody, isn't it, when they're trying to live in the world and have boyfriends and have friends and go out and have a good time.
Right.
Did you try to hide it or did you share this with your friends?
No, I isolated myself, I guess. I took on the burden of my disease with my mum, I guess. Her, you know, we both fought it together, but some of my close friends knew about it. But I think what happens is you tend to isolate yourself because you're embarrassed. You don't understand it. There's the loss of independence and dignity that goes with a chronic disease or any illness. And that made it really, really hard to face for many years.
Mm. Okay, let's hear some more music and then we'll get on with the discussion. You've chosen one of the string quartets by Mozart as a piece that you'd like to hear. Why?
You know, I think Mozart playing in the background for my children at school just sort of is a great piece for them to feel energized with and sets a great tone in the classroom.
That's the Alban-Berg Quartet and the String Quartet in G Major by Mozart, chosen by our guest today, Karen Ager. And we're talking about rheumatoid arthritis, which is a disease that she's had since she was 17, or, as we've discovered, probably much earlier. Can we talk about pain for a minute? How painful was it, is it, has it been?
It's excruciatingly painful to, you know, I had a flare-up recently and I said to my husband, we're on a plane actually on the way to Miami, and I said to him, I think I'm actually going to be physically ill from the pain, because it's when I flare, it's so severe and it comes on so quickly.
How quickly? I mean, how much warning do you get?
Well, I had hopped in the taxi and I'd gone to LaGuardia Airport, and by the time I arrived in Miami about 3 hours later, I couldn't walk, and I got off the plane and the pilot said, saw me walking off, and by the time I got out the other side of the, you know, with the arrivals, he'd called a wheelchair for me.
Are there any signals in your body that you get that a flare-up is imminent?
I think if I have I'm working really hard and I'm overtired, I'll start getting, you know, twinges of pain, and I can just feel that sort of slow, deep joint pain coming on, and then the inflammation will come after that.
Have you tried natural therapies at all?
I have.
What did you try, and how effective are they?
When I was in my early 20s, I went to a clinic in England with my mother. And the lady there was a nurse, and she'd had RA herself and had, you know, felt that she had cured herself from the disease, even though it's supposed to be incurable, with the diet and various supplements. It didn't work for me, but that's not to say it doesn't work for someone else. But I think I have a better understanding of the illness now, and that it is an autoimmune disease, and curing it with diet can be challenging, if it's possible at all. I just, you know, my rule of thumb is a well-rounded diet, really, and exercise.
Does exercise make a difference?
Yeah, the thing I actually miss about Australia is the swimming, because I would always swim in the ocean here, and that's much more difficult in New York. But my husband is a personal trainer, and he does a lot of balance activities with me, because I'm very, on my feet, I can lose my balance really quickly because of the joint pain. So we do balance and just some bike riding and things like that.
What about medication? Can you get medication in America that you can't get here?
Yeah, I was fortunate in that after a year of living in the United States, I got access to what they call biological drugs, which are either injectables or intravenous infusions, and they actually attack the cells at a much earlier phase than some of the other oral forms of medication. And so I was actually put in a clinical remission with some of those medications. It's over the course of the last 5 or 6 years, my body's actually created antibodies to some of those medicines.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
How do you know that?
Because you start getting sick again.
So, you know, your body, it's a heck mongrel disease, isn't it?
It's a real, it's so aggressive. And I'm on to my third biologic now. And recently my rheumatologist in New York wanted me to go on to a trial for yet another drug that's coming out over there, which is attacking the site or the cells earlier than even these ones that I was on. But I couldn't do it because it's, you know, it's an infusion and it impacts your lifestyle. And I was coming out here for the book tour, so I have to wait.
When did you first go to America and why? What took you there?
I went in 2000 around. I remember I was heartbroken because I had tickets to the Olympics in Sydney, and I got this job at the United Nations International School. I wanted to challenge myself with my teaching career, and that's the way I chose to do it.
Were you teaching in Melbourne prior to that?
I was actually at this stage, I'd moved to Sydney and I was teaching at King Copple in Rose Bay.
Young children?
Yeah, grade one.
Grade one, students. So you're talking 7, 8-year-olds,
six-year-olds.
Grade
one, yeah.
All right, so you applied for a job in the United Nations. Had you been to New York before that?
I actually went there for the millennium and loved it, but I'd also been there in 96 when I had met the actor Ron Silver and I'd been...
He's right about that story. That's very. It's actually very romantic, isn't it? Because you sort of did but didn't have a relationship with him.
Exactly. He's such a gracious man. And your listeners would recognise his face, I'm sure, if they Googled him.
Yeah.
Quite a familiar actor. And we met in Los Angeles, and he actually lived in New York and invited me there and just was the perfect gentleman and pursued me a little bit.
Did you imagine in 96 when... Was it 96 you met him?
Yes.
Did you imagine then that you could live in New York?
Well, he invited me to come and live with him, but I was too scared to do that. But he planted the seed and he was definitely the catalyst for my move.
And you were prepared to do this despite the fact that you suffered from a chronic degenerative incurable disease, which I think shows a sort of, some people would say it's either reckless or it shows a tremendous optimism and a tremendous determination.
Mm.
What do you think it was?
I think it's a bit of both. I've been reckless in my time, much to the horror of my parents. But also, you know, I had decided that I had to have a quality of life and I wasn't going to let the disease take over, and I had to be strong and resilient and get on with things.
Was that your point of view from the moment you were diagnosed, or did you have a change of heart for some reason?
No, it wasn't my point of view at all. The healing process from the diagnosis of a chronic disease that will always be with me has taken me 30 years almost.
How did it start?
It started from
I'm just wondering if somebody took you aside or somebody mentored you in some way, if there was some body, or did it all come from inside you?
No, I think, you know, after about 5 years of struggling with the disease and being in a wheelchair and moments where my mother had to feed me and bathe me and lift me off the toilet, I really hit rock bottom. And we went to the government office for my review of my sickness benefits because I'd been on them for 2 years.
That was in Australia?
In Australia, yes. And I'd been on them for 2 years and they decided, well, that I was unfit for work ever, and that I'd be put on an invalid pension. And that, for me, was my moment that was pivotal. I just thought, no, this disease, you know, might take my body and ruin my body, but not my soul, not my spirit.
You were aware of that thought at that time.
And I turned to my mum and I said, I'm not letting them do that.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you think that was the starting of going down a different track?
Yeah. But it still took a long time.
Is everybody capable of that, do you think? You must know a lot of other RA sufferers now, right? Do you? And do you find that everybody's had that, that a lot of people have had that sort of pivotal experience?
No, I think that particularly the women I know with the illness, I think that they suffer in silence. I think that they feel very isolated and a burden from the disease. And that's why I've started my advocacy work and I've started up a support group in Manhattan, because it's a constant challenge dealing with this illness.
Every day?
Every day, every step. Like, I'm still in pain, even though I'm on medication that's kind of controlling it. You know, every step is hard for me.
So every time someone says, let's go to a movie, you've got to actually think of getting in the car and going and getting and walking down the steps and all of that, do you?
Right, right. And how am I going to manipulate the escalator? How am I going to, you know, can I hold on tightly enough with one hand on the left and balance myself okay to get on the escalator to get to the
movies? Do you fall over at all?
I've fallen over in New York, yeah, with the snow especially.
I bet. Mm. All right, let's listen to Dave Brubeck now with Take 5, the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Why are we hearing this?
It's just, I think it's a really uplifting piece and it makes me feel happy.
That wonderful Take Five, written by Paul Desmond, played by Paul Desmond on clarinet, with Dave Brubeck piano, Eugene Wright on bass, and Joe Morello with that long extended drum solo. Fantastic. Chosen by, and Take Five is the name of it. Karen Ager chose that. And it reminds you, I think you said, of your brother, is that right?
It does remind me of my brother, Steve. He has come to New York a couple of times to visit me. And on one of our last nights together, he took me to a jazz band at a great little restaurant. So.
And he's a pilot like your dad, I think, isn't he?
He's a pilot. He's a Qantas pilot. And he did the delivery flight into Sydney for the A380. So I'm very proud, sister.
How spectacular that must be. They say that that plane is adored by passengers and crew alike.
Yes.
Now, you got a job nannying at one stage. I was reading this in your book for a very well-known rock star and his very glamorous wife. How did you get the job? How many applicants were there?
I have no idea how many applicants there were. I had a girlfriend, actually my best friend, living in Los Angeles at the time. And I just finished a year stint in Toronto in Canada as an exchange teacher. And I did not want to go home to Australia, not because I don't love my country, because I absolutely do, but I just had this sort of, I had been re-energized in my life after feeling so flat for so long that I wanted to keep sort of this travel bug going. So we're in Los Angeles and she said, look, there's this great nanny agency. Why don't you come down? It's in Beverly Hills and I think, you know, you could get a job there. I'm like, okay. And then this job with this rock and roller came up.
And you got it.
And I got it.
Tell me what it was like going into that world.
You know, I think there's different levels of fame, and he is so famous that he is really at the level where he's kind of back to normalcy. And so, you know, he would make his children prune the roses for pocket money. And, you know, they were living in a beautiful house. But at the end of the day, really what I saw that they valued was a meal with the family and a fine wine and good music. And
you draw a picture of a somewhat restricted life, given that they are so famous. And you're not permitted really to talk about this person by name because you've signed a confidentiality agreement. So we have to be very sort of mysterious about all of this. But you talk about a trip to England, right, and you live within the four walls of the compound. When they can't lead a sort of an average life, can they?
No, they tend to have guests over. I think that's the easiest thing for them. And I think sometimes that they would probably feel, I don't want to say in prison, but very confined by, you know, the houses that they live in, and it's difficult for them.
Was he a good boss?
He was a great boss, a great boss. And, you know, I felt bad for him on occasions because we'd be just walking through the airport and the public would be slanderous, just call out slanderous comments. You know, I guess there's a lot of envy and jealousy out there, and they have to deal with a lot.
Hmm. What brought the job to an end? Tell us that story.
I got sick.
Hmm.
And it was really, you know, if I ever see them again, I would really want to apologize to them for not...
For being sick?
No, for not telling them about my RA when I took the job, because I didn't tell them because, you know, I felt that this was an opportunity. And I'd never really been open about my disease.
Was there deformity in your hands at that time?
Yeah, there was.
And you don't think they knew?
No, they didn't know. But what ended up happening is with, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, because you're on medications that suppress the immune system, because the immune system is overactive, you are prone to infection. And so I got a really bad kidney infection and I was put into hospital for 2 weeks and I felt like I let them down.
So you had to leave, you had to resign. Leave. Were they sad to stop it? They were sad to see you go, were they?
Yeah, it was hard. And they sent me off with CDs and signed autographed pictures and they were really good to me.
The school that you teach in is a United Nations school, which I'm really interested in. Tell me about it. What is it?
The United Nations School is an international school in Manhattan. It's about a mile from the UN building itself. It has children there from 100 different countries or more.
Who are these children?
They're children of diplomats predominantly, although the numbers are actually changing. There are also children of foreigners in New York, and it can be very difficult to get your child into a school mid-year in Manhattan. So this sort of eases the transition when people are transferred with their posts and have to come to the UN.
Yeah. So what sort of nationalities do you have amongst your class? You're teaching six-year-olds again, aren't you?
Actually, I've moved into a learning specialist role. So I'm teaching children from 5 to 10 at the moment, which is a bit of a change from the book where I was teaching the grade 2 children. There are children from Russia, from Asia, from all the different continents, from everywhere in the world, really. It's amazing.
What language are you teaching? In English?
Yes, it's predominantly English, but we teach, they have language classes. They have French and Spanish classes every day. And there's Japanese after school.
Do any of these children arrive not speaking English?
Absolutely.
So yes. How does the school deal with that?
We have an English as a second language program as well.
So they're doing that.
Yeah.
And being taught in English. So they've really got to be scamper along and pick up the language fairly quickly, don't they?
Yeah, we really need them to get the foundations in English before they can go and do anything else. Mm.
You have an interest. The school has an interesting way of teaching conflict resolution. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, we very much carry on, I think, the mission of the United Nations, where each classroom has a peace corner, and the children are really trained from kindergarten to resolve
a peace corner.
A peace corner. Yes. So it's a couch and a globe, and the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's picture on the wall, and from an early age, the children are taught to use I messages. So rather than you did this, you did that, it's I feel. And so they, if they're having a problem, they go to the corner and they solve their own problems without an adult, and it works.
What if they're having a problem with the kid sitting at the table next door to them? And they want to go to the but the child that doesn't, that they're having a conflict with, doesn't want to go. I mean, how do they negotiate that?
They invite them to the peace table. You have to go to the peace table or the peace corner
if you're asked.
Yes.
So I'm having a problem.
Yes.
I need you to come. And
yes.
Does that work?
It works.
Have you watched it?
I've watched it work. It really works because you're empowering the children.
Good heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And you were in New York on 9/11.
Yes.
And
I
you
was
write
there.
Very movingly about that. Mm. When did you know what was going on down there?
Actually, that's still quite an emotional thing. I was teaching grade 2 and we were doing a spelling lesson, and I had an assistant in the class because I had a little girl who was disabled. And she got a phone call, and her husband had said that, you know, a plane had just hit one of the world towers, and we just thought it was a light aircraft and a bit of a mistake, so none of the kids sort of knew at that time. And then when the second one came in, obviously we knew, and we just worked. We didn't tell the children. We just worked it. You know, running a normal classroom for the day. They had a few treats come around.
That must have been hard for the staff.
It was really hard, and we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know if we were in danger, but all I wanted to do was look after my children, and there was no way I was leaving that building until every single one of my children had been picked up by their parents. And the school year was just a couple of days old.
Mm.
So I didn't know, I barely knew their names.
Oh, gosh.
Mm.
Gosh, what a day. Okay, let's listen to this. This is Rod Stewart. Tell me what we're hearing Rod Stewart singing.
You know, I really would like your listeners to listen to the words of this beautiful Rod Stewart song. It's a song where I reflect on my life.
Handbags and Glad Rags, Rod Stewart, and chosen by our guest today, Karen Ager. Karen, tell us about Jeffrey Gotfirst. He's created a foundation. Who is he?
Jeff has become a friend of mine. We met on Twitter, would you believe? And he has created this foundation in the States which grants wishes and dreams for children with arthritis.
Did he have it? Or does he have it?
He has it, and he's just recently made an attempt to be the first man to climb Mount Everest with RA. He didn't make it, but he's going back next year.
So he's determined, isn't he?
He's determined, yes. We're a good partnership.
When I read about it, I wondered if you'd been offered a dream fulfillment when you were 17, have you ever thought what it might have been?
To write my book.
Well, you did it.
I did it. Yes.
When did you start writing? How long ago?
You know, I kept journals ever since I was a little girl, and I'd always liked to write. And, you know, it changed over the years of just recounting experiences to really reflecting and learning from them. And then I just started to pull it all together, and a few people kept saying, you know, you've got a great story to tell. It's not just about your RA, but you've been through so many other things, so many other struggles that people would relate to.
Yes, so. It's very inspiring. It's a sort of cautionary tale in many ways for young girls, particularly in terms of relationships and all that sort of thing.
Right, because the story really covers, the thread is the RA, but you know, because of my arthritis, I think I chose relationships that weren't right for me. Yeah. I struggled to accept, you know, perhaps advice from my parents when I should have taken it. You know, I've been a victim of some domestic violence. All those sorts of things have come into it. But I, you know, and my own marriage now, I'm married to Matthew, and we've got a great marriage, but we've had our issues, and we've worked through them. So I think it's a story of great hope and resilience and strength.
Certainly is. Thank you for telling it, and thank you for coming in today and talking about it.
It's been a great pleasure.
And Karen, you've chosen Bruckner, Symphony No. 7. Why?
I like this song because for me it's a time when I consider what I have and show, you know, I really count my blessings and I appreciate just everyday moments.
Fourth movement of the Symphony No. 7 by Bruckner, the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Sir George Scholte. Final choice of our guest today, Karen Ager. Her surname is spelled A-G-E-R. The book she's written about her story is called Enemy Within, published by New Holland Press. Tomorrow, Midori, violinist, Japanese-American violinist of great fame. She was one of those who stepped up at the last minute for somebody who got sick, and she was only 11 at the time, and she's been a star ever since. I mean, that is interesting in itself. Midori joins us at the usual time tomorrow, and Damien will be here with Just Classics after the news.
This feature was produced by ABC Classic FM. You'll find more audio of our programs, along with special features for download, on our website at abc.net.au/classic/audio.